But tonight I want to present an overview of one important component of the work of St. Thomas Aquinas, one that has relevance to an array of contemporary questions in ethics, theology, government, and law, the idea of natural law. Is this loud enough in the back? Okay, let me know if I wear out or get quiet a little. Okay, I want to begin with an anecdote that points to a problem with the very term that names my subject, a problem nicely illustrated by a story I once heard in graduate school from my professor, David Solomon, who's at the bottom there. A few years ago, Professor Solomon told me, I appeared on Firing Line. That's an old television show. Maybe nobody knows it anymore, but once upon a time, William F. Buckley would invite people on and have discussions of not the kind that we think of when we think of Firing Line today, but intellectually serious discussion. Anyway, so a few years ago, I appeared on Firing Line with my Notre Dame colleagues, Gerhard Niemeyer and Ralph McInerney, for a discussion of natural law. My memory of that occasion is vivid. Our attempt to discuss the possibilities for the theory of natural law in the contemporary intellectual climate was frustrated throughout by the way we seemed to be talking about three different subjects. Father Niemeyer approached the topic of natural law as if it essentially concerned moral objectivity, and from his point of view, Kant was as much a defender of the theory of natural law as Suarez. McInerney and I quibbled about how much of the specifically Thomist project can still be defended, and William F. Buckley, the host of the program, was primarily concerned about whether a natural law argument could be mounted to show that the progressive income tax was unjust. In short, we spent most of the program simply talking past one another. So tonight, I want to present St. Thomas' theory of natural law as a composite of six related theses. The problem in that discussion, and elsewhere, I think, is that different people use the term as a name for just one or another of those theses. It's not exactly the problem of the blind man and the elephant in that famous Buddhist parable. It's just that the term is narrowed in different ways by different users, ways that unsurprisingly led to misunderstanding. It's helpful to keep that diversity of views in mind as one uses or listens to others who use the term natural law. So, I want to begin as a background by putting the natural law in the larger context of St. Thomas' magnum opus, the Summa Theologiae. The second part of that Summa is devoted to man inasmuch as he is the principle of his actions, as having free will and control of those actions, or in other words, to morality. The first part of that second part begins with a discussion of the ends of human life, happiness with God in heaven, but also here on earth. This is a Christian version of the first book of Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. Next, St. Thomas turns to the means to happiness, human actions, and to the principles, the foundations of those actions. Some of those principles are within us, powers such as choice and habits, such as courage or cowardice, generosity or stinginess. Others of the principles are not within us. External to us, Thomas says, are the devil tempting us to do evil and God helping us to be good. That help God provides us in two ways, by instruction and by more direct assistance, that is, by law and by grace. So there's some places over there. Of course, these are only the ultimate external sources of our actions. More immediately, the temptations come through bad company, the help in choosing to act, from the example set for us by our heroes, and from the laws of the community in which we live. That, what I just said about God and the devil, might suggest that the concept of natural law is so theological as to have little relevance to agnostics or atheists. I hope to show, however, that that's not the case. We begin to see that as we turn to the more particular locus of the concept of natural law, the part of the Summa called the Treatise on Law. The first question of that treatise identifies the essence of law and states it as a definition. I think we can understand the text best if we think of the definition as being partly inductive and partly idealization. Inductively, it's abstracted from the kind of law with which we're most familiar, the kind we make ourselves as we govern the community in which we live. As an idealization, it's a kind of what good law would be. To clarify that, think of a slight adaptation of Euclid's definition of a circle. What's a circle? It's a figure, every point on which is equidistant from a given point, its center. Someone might object that the term circle usefully names many things in this world, coins, tabletops, traffic intersections, and not one of those things conforms exactly to Euclid's definition. I mean, the points aren't exactly right. To this, Euclid would surely reply that those things are circles only to the extent that they approximate the definition. It would be true, though excessively pedantic, for the furniture dealer to say that he had no circular tables for sale, though he did have ones that were approximately circular. So it would be with law, especially when it comes to human laws, even though it's from them which we abstracted the concept. So what's the essence of law? First, following the Socratic approach to definition, what kind of a thing is it? What's its genus? It's an action of putting something into order. I'm going to leave that in the Latin ordinatio, because as you say, ordination, that creates confusion again. So it's an ordinatio, putting things in order. But there are lots of kinds of ordinationes. What makes law different from, say, cleaning up one's room? Here, in principle, we need the specific difference, but we'll settle for some characteristics that follow from that difference. In the terminology of Aristotelian logic, some properties. So to start, law, to be law, is made by competent authority. Competent authority doesn't mean one that knows what he's doing. It means one that has the authority to do it. So by the city council, not by the neighborhood garden club. Next, it's for the common good, not for the private good of those who happen to be in power. Go ahead and take a minute to find yourself a place. So it's made by competent authority. It's for the common good. Third, it's reasonable, not capricious. Finally, it has to be made known to those whose actions it attempts to regulate. It has to be promulgated. Laws, good laws anyway, have all those features, or at least approximate them as the ideal in virtue of which they're called law at all. In this, St. Thomas differs from what are sometimes called legal positivists, for whom law is whatever is passed by the legislature, the question of whether the law is morally good and so on being an entirely distinct question. St. Thomas next identifies four ordinationes that have all of those properties. First, of course, are the human laws, such as the United States Code, from which we abstracted and idealized the definition in the first place. What are the others? Christians, Muslims, and Jews all share a theology in which God, among other things, provides human beings with a code of laws, the Ten Commandments, for example. This, Thomas calls divine law, additional law whereby man shares more perfectly in the eternal law. Eternal law? Natural objects, from falling objects to nut-gathering squirrels, act in regular ways. St. Thomas saw in this regularity a plan grounded in divine wisdom which directs all the actions and movements of created things. Even those who do not recognize any deeper grounding in divine wisdom talk about the law of gravity, the gas laws, and so on, laws of nature. St. Thomas called the regularities that constitute the implementation of this plan eternal law. I can't do everything in one lecture, so I would elaborate on St. Thomas' claim that these regularities meet all the terms of his characterization of law. There is, however, a fourth ordinatio that St. Thomas identifies as being law, the human knowledge that we ought to do certain things and to avoid others, the principles of morality, the moral law, or should I put the accent differently and say the moral law? Anyway, St. Thomas thought that the moral law was just another aspect of the eternal law. It too is part of that of a plan grounded in divine wisdom which directs the actions and movements of some created things, but with a difference. Rocks and even squirrels don't really have any choices to make. They fall or gather nuts under the influence of their lapidary or scurrine natures. Human beings, by contrast, are free to seek the happiness that constitutes the end of human life in various ways, including ineffective or even counterproductive ones against which the moral principles warn us. Morality, St. Thomas argues, includes a component that meets the definition of law. It is indeed the rational being's way of participating in the eternal law, and he calls it natural law. This can be confusing. I have to emphasize this whenever I'm teaching, because natural law, we think back to science and so on. But St. Thomas meant by natural law something different. Why did he call morality natural law? We can find the root of the answer in Aristotle. Here's a passage from the Rhetoric. Aristotle says, just and unjust actions have been defined relatively to two kinds of law, particular law and universal law. Particular law is that which each community lays down and applies to its own members. Universal law is the law of nature. For there really is, as everyone to some extent divines, a natural justice and injustice that's binding on all men, even on those who have no association or covenant with each other. It's this that Sophocles' Antigone clearly means when she says that the burial of Polynices, her brother, was a just act in spite of the prohibition that was prohibited by the king. She means it was just by nature. So that's Aristotle. The details of a writer's, here's an example, details of a writer's legal liability for libel, insult, or hate mongering vary from one country to another. American libel law emphasizes freedom of speech. English libel law emphasizes protection of reputation. It's much easier to get a libel judgment against somebody for defaming you in England than it is in the United States. There is, however, something wrong with libel, insult, and hate mongering, even in an unregistered ship on the high seas beyond the jurisdiction of any human law. So there's a kind of human law in a particular society, and then deep underlying that is an idea of natural law that applies not just because of some legislature, but of some act of legislation, but for some deeper reason. Most of the ideas which I just presented will be worth more extended treatment, but here I'll focus on just one. St. Thomas' elaboration of the idea of natural law, identifying six component theses which I mentioned in the beginning of the lecture. I'll not have time to give fully elaborated arguments for each of these theses. My goal here is to show the integrity of the big picture and to help you understand the term natural law in its various more particular uses. So, natural law and the nature of ethics, that's going to be the first subject of the first two theses. Let's begin with this. The principles of morality are universal and immutable truths. In this, St. Thomas rejects both the idea that there are no moral truths, that there are none at all, as moral nihilism, and the idea that the truths vary from one culture to another, moral relativism. The grounds of moral truth, the ground is human nature, which is the same for all human beings. So culture does not, as long as we keep the discussion at a fairly general level, make some actions or habits good and others bad. The best response to relativism is, I think, the articulation of a plausible account of what those objective moral principles are and how we know them. That's coming right up. But since part of the resistance to the idea that there are such culture-independent truths is the fear that they would lead to intolerance, I do want to take a minute to tell a story illustrating the fact that the idea that we all have, that a duty of tolerance will have to find its ground somewhere other than, sorry, lost my emphasis. I do want to take a minute to tell a story illustrating the fact that the idea that we all have a duty of tolerance will have to find its ground somewhere other than in cultural relativism. So the story I want to tell is about Sir Charles Napier, a British general during the British conquest of India, and his approach to the problem of sati, or widow burning, in an area under his control. This is how his brother tells the story. Charles Napier put down the practice of satis, which however was rare in Sindh, by a process entirely characteristic. For judging the real cause of these immolations to be the profit derived by the priests, and hearing of an intended burning, he made it known that he would stop the sacrifice. The priests said it was a religious rite which must not be meddled with, that all nations had customs which should be respected, and this was a very sacred one. The general, affecting to be struck with the argument, replied, "Be it so. This burning of widows is your custom. Prepare the funeral pyre. But my nation has also a custom. When men burn women alive, we hang them and confiscate all their property. Like carpenters, therefore, shall elect their gibbets on which to hang all concerned when the widow's consumed. Let's all act according to our national customs. No study took place then or afterwards, as Brother said. It looks like cultural relativism would approve both the priest's burning of widows and the general's punishing it. I think that what we need here is some kind of principle of tolerance, but not one strong enough to require that Napier tolerate Sutty. Whatever exactly that principle is, it should be of general application. It requires a ground in an objective theory of morals. So, second thesis tells us how we can know the moral truths that the first thesis presupposes or asserts to exist. So, thesis number two, the principles of morality are known by natural reason. This challenges not only moral skepticism, it says we can't know them at all, but also those theories, too popular, I think, among some conservative Protestants, according to which morality depends entirely on revealed religion. Weaker or stronger versions of the divine command theory. Just one example of that, William Jennings Bryan said, morality is dependent upon religion, and religion is the only basis for morality. If God doesn't reveal it to us, we couldn't know right from wrong. Or worse still, until God assigns moral predicates to actions and habits, there wouldn't be any good or bad at all. Is natural reason really capable of answering the fundamental questions of ethics? To see how, according to St. Thomas, it does this, let's look at his account of the logical structure of moral argument. According to St. Thomas, it begins with a self-evident truth. Something as knowable to any rational being as are the principles of Euclid's geometry or the basic equations of arithmetic. And he draws conclusions from there. Ethics doesn't require revelation or faith. Catholic and Muslim, Catholic and Buddhist, Catholic and atheist can identify that starting point and can follow the same line of reasoning. And so, Damien Kuhn noted in his book on Buddhist ethics, I'm going to quote from him for a couple lines, he noted a close resemblance between Tibetan Buddhist and traditional Christian teachings on sexual ethics. Certain of the Dalai Lama's pronouncements, he said, could almost have been issued by the Vatican, and his views on abortion and euthanasia also closely resemble Catholic teachings. That's Damien Kuhn. That's not surprising, St. Thomas might say. They make babies in Lhasa the same way they do in Limerick and Lublin. That religion is not necessary to our knowledge of moral, or that religion is not necessary to our knowledge of moral truths, does not mean that it plays no role in our struggle to be good. It can play a role in three different ways. I'll offer briefly the Catholic account. Details will vary from one religion to another. First, revelation, divine law, provides greater certainty than natural law can do. The certainty that's a feature of reasoning for mathematical principles is not a feature of moral reasoning. Even mathematicians, of course, can make mistakes in reasoning, and for them, except when they're trying to balance their checkbooks, the results of the reasoning don't really interfere with their desires as readily as is the case with moral reasoning, where certain results might make demands on the conduct of the reasoner's life. It's easy to live with the fact that there are as many even counting numbers as there are counting numbers even or odd. It's sometimes harder to live with the fact that, say, intentional killing of civilians in wartime is always wrong, as the now famous case of Navy's SEAL Marcus Luttrell made clear. I don't know whether you read his book, Lone Survivor. I think there was in a movie about that. You can go look at the details. But you see the general idea. In the battlefield, it can all of a sudden be hard to do the right thing. As his story shows, acceptance of the conclusions of moral reasoning sometimes comes at personal cost. Second, grace supplements the instruction given by law. How do we get it? Prayer and the reception of the sacraments, says the church, are reliable, though not the exclusive means of obtaining grace. Religion guides our prayer, the church administers the sacraments. Grace not only helps us get to heaven, it helps us be kind to our annoying neighbors and co-workers. Finally, religion provides inspiration. Of course we can find inspiration in secular biographies of Washington or Lincoln or Grant, but we find it in a richer way in the Gospels than in the lives of the saints. So, we're going to the third thesis. First two theses tell us something about ethics. But what does ethics itself, natural law, tell us about how to live? First, is there really some principle of ethics that no rational person can deny? There is. Thesis number three. First precept of the natural law, good is to be done and pursued, and evil is to be avoided. Who can disagree? Certainly not the utilitarians, Jeremy Bentham and John Stuart Mill, whom so many Thomists see as their natural enemies. Their principle, the utilitarian principle, is that actions are right in proportion as they tend to promote happiness, wrong as they tend to produce the reverse of happiness. The good to be done, according to them, is what produces the greatest happiness, that is, pleasure for the greatest number of people. What about the deontologists, Immanuel Kant and W.D. Ross, for example? Squaring the fundamental character of thesis number three with what they do say about the right as different from the good would require a lecture of its own. But it's hard to imagine them denying that the good is to be done and pursued. Thesis number three may be undeniable, but is it helpful? It obviously has to be supplemented by some account of exactly which ends, actions or habits, are good and which are bad. That'll give us more precise secondary and tertiary precepts. The first step of supplementation is what distinguishes St. Thomas from the utilitarians. So, thesis four. Thomas says, goodness is a fullness of being or perfection of one's nature. Lots of the things around us, though not all of them, are understood by reference to some characteristic function with reference to which we can and without which we cannot distinguish good ones from bad ones. It's not clear what would make a stick, per se, a good stick. If I say, go get me a good stick, what are you going to do with it? I mean, otherwise I don't know how to sort them out. But it's perfectly clear what makes a watch a good watch. Similarly for occupations and the characteristic activities associated with them. The goodness of a quarterback has nothing to do with his grade point average, right? Or with whether he remembers his mother's birthday. And we realize as we think about it that St. Dismas, the man whom tradition calls the good thief, was not really a good thief. He got caught. But the term good thief suggests a point of reference beyond his occupation, his human nature. We need a point of reference with the term good just as we do with big and small. No one is confused when told that a big mouse is not as big as a small elephant. What's the characteristic activity of human beings with reference to which we make judgments about human goodness? Following Aristotle, St. Thomas emphasizes rationality, concept formation, judgment and reasoning, intention of ends, and a choice of effective, appropriate means of attaining them. Those are the powers that constitute the human nature that makes us different from animals. St. Dismas wasn't just a thief. He was not even essentially a thief. He was first and essentially a human, a rational being. The injustice of his actions as a thief manifested a failure to recognize the distinction between mine and yours, which a rational being should be able to do. That failure is hardly a fault in the crows that rob our cornfields, but in a human, it is a failure fully to actualize his rational powers. Dismas' repentance as he was dying was a step in that actualization, enough to make him a good thief, the reference point being not his occupation, but his humanity. So, how does a rational being act? The list of cardinal virtues tells us what habits he should have. He should give each person his due. He should face dangers when the good at stake is important enough, but not otherwise. The American paratroopers jumping into Normandy, but not Sam Patch jumping into Niagara Falls. He resists inordinate pleasures. So the venerable Mount Talbot, the alcoholic who may one day be a saint, not Don Juan. A rational being doesn't get drunk, he doesn't commit murder or adultery or theft. As we begin to identify particular goods and to determine the suitable means to achieve those goods, however, the certainty with which the first precept is known sometimes recedes into the background. It doesn't recede for certain prohibitions, which according to St. Thomas remain absolute. The prohibition of intentional killing of innocent human beings is one example. That means not only the kind of indiscriminate aerial bombardment of cities that was undertaken in World War II, but also abortion and euthanasia. St. Thomas also argues that the natural function of our bodily powers must be respected in a way that it clearly is not in cases of fornication and contraception. Each of these judgments, to be sure, has its deniers. Harry Truman, Jack Kevorkian, Don Juan, Margaret Sanger. Elaboration on any of them would require a lecture on its own. For other moral judgments, however, the matter is different. That peace is good is clear enough to almost everyone. Maybe Benito Mussolini doubted it. I found a passage in the old Encyclopedia Italiana that where he talks about how good war is for everybody and stuff like that. But that's just one of the reasons the rest of us refuse to take people like him as moral guides. So we can still assert the secondary precept, pursue peace, with a fair degree of certainty. What exactly is peace? Presumably it's more than just an absence of war. How do we pursue it? What answers does history provide to that important question? Here, real differences arise, and between people whom we cannot dismiss as easily as we can dismiss Mussolini. And one answer, quoted down to our own day, came from Flavius Vegetius Renatus, the 4th century Roman general and the first Christian to write on military matters. If you want peace, he wrote, prepare for war. A modern defender of the soundness of this maxim might point to European history between 1933 and 1939. On the 9th of February, 1933, attendees at a debate sponsored by the Oxford Union resolved in no circumstances to fight for its king and country. Churchill thought that the Oxford Pledge and its like only encouraged the aggressiveness that Germany manifested in the years that followed, from the reoccupation of the Rhineland through the Anschluss to the attack on Poland that began the Second World War. Other people, looking at the years leading to 1914, drew exactly the opposite conclusion, that the preparations for war, the alliances, the armaments, the mobilization plans only made war more likely, if not inevitable. The precept that follows from Pursue Peace, in their view, was not prepare for war, but disarm, avoid entangling alliances, and so on. Each of us may want to claim to be right in the conclusion we draw about how to pursue peace, but no one can deny that there is some loss of certainty between the first precept, good is to be done, and the policy proposal. The good is to be done may be a self-evident truth, but about the tertiary precepts that will guide our actions in particular situations, we can claim no more than that they're prudential judgments, lacking the certainty with which we can assert even many secondary precepts. So, next, I want now to turn back to a more explicit reference to the concept of law and a natural law's relation to other kinds of law. The four kinds of law that I named are not four species of a genus. They're related to one another in various ways, as whole and part, eternal and natural law, as core and sub. Whole and part, that would be eternal and natural law. As core and supplement, that would be eternal law and divine law. And as we shall see, as grounded and derivative, natural law and human law. But the next of the six theses is this. Morality fits the definition of law. Morality is, that is to say, an ordinatio of reason for the common good made by him who has the care of the community and promulgated. Morality is a rational creature's way of participating in the divine plan for the governance of creation, that is, in the eternal law. This thesis does four things. First, it adds something to Aristotelian ethics. Although Aristotle did refer to something like natural law in the passage of the Rhetoric that I quoted above, his Nicomachean ethics is very much centered on moral virtue rather than moral law, on character rather than precept. To be sure, he would say that one ought to be just and not to commit adultery and so on. To see what he does and what he does not do in saying that, however, consider two possible defenses of the idea that one ought to stop at red traffic lights. Answer number one, one might be hurt in an accident if one doesn't stop. Answer number two, traffic laws require one to do so. The first answer is grounded in the pursuit of real human goods. The second is grounded in the idea of obedience to authority. What insight can that provide us on the justification for the claim that one ought to obey moral rules? Aristotle's ethics is well prepared to justify moral rules in the first way. It's not clear that he can offer the second kind of justification, the one that appeals to some authoritative lawmaker. St. Thomas, as a good Aristotelian, can also offer the first type. As a Christian who embeds morality into the eternal law, he makes God the legislator and natural law, one part of God's act of legislation, which enables him to offer the second type as well. The agnostic cannot, to be sure, see this, but that only means that he will have trouble seeing morality as law, that is, as having all the properties of law, and accepting thesis number 5. He'll have no trouble, even as an agnostic, accepting the content of natural law as spelled out in thesis number 3 and 4. The thoughtful agnostic can see the pieces to be pursued as readily as can the most pious Christian. Second, St. Thomas avoids a problem faced by Kant, who also saw morality as law and recognized that law requires a lawgiver, but thought that morality could not be something in any way imposed on a person by any other person, not even by God. Kant tries to show that in the case of the moral, law, persons give that moral law to themselves. There are, to be sure, Kantians who think that he succeeded in this, or almost did. His critics object that what one gives to oneself, however sound it may be as guidance on how to put one's life in order, is not law. I can't resolve that controversy here. I can only acknowledge myself to be among the critics. Third, St. Thomas shows us how the moral law and the laws of nature, or of science, can be said to be laws in the same sense. There are philosophers who think that they see an equivocation here. There is, to be sure, a difference between, say, Kepler's laws and the Mann Act, and any precept of the moral law is more like the latter than it is like the former. Planets, to oversimplify, invariably follow Kepler's laws. They never simply disobey it. Human beings, sad to say, disobey the natural law all the time. Part of the point of attaching penalties to the criminal laws that reinforce the natural law, for example, putting people in prison for human trafficking, is that we know that people will disobey the natural law in certain respects, and we want to put those people in jail where they'll not be able to do so again. But scientific laws and the natural law, here exemplified by the human law that is derived from it, have in common that they're both parts of God's plan for creation, different only in the diverse ways appropriate to non-rational and rational beings. The univocal character of the term law, its suitability for naming regularities discovered by science, is perhaps one of the points that agnostics will not be able to see, though they may be able to construct some account of the various uses of the term being analogical, like healthy and its different applicability to one's diet and one's appearance. Fourth, St. Thomas allows us to see how a theory of ethics can be embedded in Catholic theology and at the same time be of value to agnostics. Agnostics can know the natural law in the sense that they know its content, and they know that they ought to follow it, even if ought has for them only the Aristotelian sense. They may not recognize it as law in the full sense that St. Thomas attributes to the term, but if there is any difference between them and theists, it'll be over the meta-ethical nature of the rules of morality, not over their content. So, the final of the 6 theses relates natural law to human law, that is, to questions of government. Moral principles are the foundation and standard of human law, Thomas says. St. Thomas characterizes human law as a particular determination of certain matters in natural law by human reason. Although a popular maxim has it that one cannot, or in a weaker version at least should not, legislate morality, St. Thomas' more sensible alternative view is that one should not legislate anything else. The only justifiable use of the power of government is to make sure that people do what they have a moral obligation to do. One needs to understand moral obligation broadly here. I think some people sometimes don't. Do I have a moral obligation to drive carefully? Yes, I want to say. Some people will think when morality, they're off thinking about something else. Anyway, the only justification to use the power of the government is to make sure that people do what they have a moral obligation to do, or that they refrain from what they have an obligation not to do. They shouldn't kill one another, and so murder is made a felony. They should drive safely, so we get the speed limit to facilitate enforcement and the requirement to drive on the right side of the road, except on islands, to coordinate our choices. I'm going to England next week, so I've got to make sure. Concede that they handle things a little differently. They should pay their fair share of the costs of community life, and on that basis we write the tax code. There is, to be sure, a limit here. There are some things that human law cannot handle well. That no parent should punish a child more severely than the child deserves is certainly a sound moral principle. a precept of the natural law. But to try to turn that into a statute in the criminal code would, except in the case of child abuse, do more harm than good. Even with respect to the prohibition of morally objectionable speech, governments don't have a very good track record with respect to avoiding overreach. Not every precept derivable from natural law should be made into human law. The implication of all of this is clear enough in the State House, where the legislator should be guided by the natural law in making laws. Does this final thesis have any relevance for the rest of us, for citizens, for judges? There's unfortunately no guarantee that the legislators will get this right. First, the legislature might do something that it has no right to do. For example, in 1990, Congress enacted the Gun-Free School Zones Act of 1990, despite the fact that nothing in the Constitution allows it to make that kind of criminal law. That's what he means by incompetent authority or competent authority. Second, it might do something that's not really for the common good, or that is, but does so in a way that's contrary to reason, silently by imposing burdens that are unfair, as of the Conscription of Act of 1863 with its provision for a $300 commutation fee. Finally, and worst of all, it might require people to do something that's morally forbidden or forbid them from doing something that's morally required. Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 required ordinary citizens to assist the recapture of fugitive slaves. That'll be one example. Soviet law prohibiting teaching religion to children would be another. This leads us to two distinct questions: civil disobedience and conscientious refusal, on the one hand, and judicial review, on the other. So, the first one. Human laws, which are, in fact, properly grounded in the natural law, create, for those subject to them, by the very fact of their proper grounding, a moral obligation to obey them. What about cases that are not so grounded? To begin with the easy case, St. Thomas says that when there's a conflict between moral law and human law, the moral law prevails. What one must do or may not do is not affected by human law commanding one to act differently. This may be called the duty of conscientious refusal, or, if the term is broadened from its narrower focus on military service, conscientious objection. In the case of legislative mistakes of the other types, laws not made by the competent authority or not for the common good or unfairly burdensome, the matter is more complex. In such cases, the general obligation to obey well-grounded laws mentioned above does not apply. One might, however, still have an obligation of obedience for other reasons. Disobedience might, for example, set a bad example, give scandal in the old sense of that term, thereby encouraging a disrespect for law that will undermine others' willingness to obey even good laws when they find it inconvenient to do so. One must sometimes yield one's right to disobey laws that are unjust in the first two senses, or the two just mentioned. If no such other considerations apply, then one's at liberty to disobey the law. The importance of minimizing the pernicious side effects of disobedience, even to problematic laws, was, I think, recognized by Mohandas Gandhi and is evident in the rules which he established as constitutive of the practice which he called satyagraha. Here are some examples of the things that he expected participants in his campaigns to respect. A civil resister will harbor no anger. He will suffer the anger of his opponent. When any person in authority seeks to arrest a civil resister, he will voluntarily submit to the arrest. In the course of the struggle, if anyone insults an official or commits an assault upon him, a civil resister will protect such official or officials from the insult or attack, even at the risk of his own life. Why would Gandhi expect the civil resister to act in this way? It seems to me that he had in mind the same kind of concerns that led St. Thomas to qualify the moral permission to disobey weakly unjust laws. One must take into consideration the side effects of one's disobedience. This is one way, there are others, of elaborating the idea of civil disobedience. Does Thesis 6 also give judges a duty or a right to review human laws for conformity to natural law? The judicial review is the responsibility of judges in the case of the first of the three kinds of defect distinguished above. Well, maybe I should say which, because I think I maybe listed them different ways different times. In one of the ways has been accepted American practice almost since the foundation of the Republic. When William Marbury, one of the Adams administration's midnight judges, went to the U.S. Supreme Court to get a writ of mandamus requiring the new Secretary of State, James Madison, to issue him the commission which he'd been granted by the outgoing administration, the court refused to do so. The Judiciary Act of 1789 had authorized the court to issue such writs, but, said Chief Justice John Marshall in his opinion of the case, the Constitution did not authorize such an assignment of jurisdiction. More recent cases have been more controversial, or at least controversial in other ways. In 1979, the court decided in a 5-4 decision that the state of Texas could not forbid the burning of the American flag as an act of protest. The First Amendment, as applied to the states via the 14th, did not allow state legislators to make such laws. That's constitutional review. In the most straightforward sense, courts will not do what the Constitution does not authorize them to do, nor will it apply or allow state laws to apply laws which legislators have no authority to make. Another type of defect is more complicated, requiring it does as it does different kind of judgment. In an 1887 prohibition case, the U.S. Supreme Court wrote, "It is not at all followed that every statute enacted ostensibly for the protection of public morals, public health, or public safety is to be accepted as a legitimate exertion of the police powers of the state. If a statute purporting to have been enacted to protect those goods has no real or substantial relation to those objects or is a palpable invasion of rights secured by the fundamental law, it is the duty of the courts to so adjudge and thereby give effect to the Constitution." In 1891, the court used that same principle to declare unconstitutional a Texas law which imposed on railroad companies a tort liability distinct from that imposed on other corporations. A legal distinction in liability, the court said, must be based upon some reasonable ground, some difference which bears a just and proper relation to the attempted classification and is not a mere arbitrary selection. Otherwise, it violates the Equality Clause of the 14th Amendment. Such applications of what has come to be called a rational basis test show the willingness of the courts to review laws on the basis of the second of the three modes of failure mentioned above. The ground the court claimed was constitutional, but the cases are interpretive in a somewhat extended sense. They both insist on limits to the principle of legislative deference. Do American courts go so far as to make a direct appeal to the natural law in striking down statutes? In an 18th century inheritance case, Justice Samuel Chase said that of course they should. To maintain that our federal or state legislature possesses powers to violate the purposes for which men enter into society, if it had not been expressly restrained, would, in my opinion, be a political heresy, altogether inadmissible in our free republic. So whether the Constitution prohibits it or not, if the legislature is violating these principles on which we form a society, the court should strike the law down. His colleague on the bench, James Iredell, warned against the dangers of such an approach. He wrote, "If, on the other hand, the legislature shall pass a law within the general scope of its constitutional power, the court cannot pronounce it to be void merely because it is, in the court's judgment, contrary to the principles of natural justice. The ideas of natural justice are regulated by no fixed standard. The ablest and purest of men are different on the subject, and all that the court could properly say in such an event would be that the legislature, possessed of an equal right of opinion, had passed an act which, in the opinion of the judges, was inconsistent with the abstract principles of natural justice." Chase's remark, however, was dictum, without precedential value, and American judges in the past generally felt that judicial review on the basis of natural law rather than of the Constitution was not legitimate. More recently, however, judges have been increasingly willing to take upon themselves a task of making precisely such natural justice reviews. The passages central to decisions about whether one may kill one's unborn children and about the definition of marriage show a kind of reasoning very different from the deliberations of the Gulf Railway Court about differential tort liability for railroads. At the heart of liberty, Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. What does that mean in practice? Not the right to use opium or to try unapproved medical remedies in desperate cases or even to have a legally recognized polygamous family, though it does in some circumstances mean the right to kill one's children and does mean the right to marry anyone who's not a relative as long as there's only one of them and they're not already married to somebody else. I mean, that's the way the courts have run with that phrase of Judge Kennedy. Or Justice Kennedy. Why does the liberty reach the abortion clinic but not the opium den? The only plausible answer is that Kennedy reviewed the laws by reference to his understanding of natural law, just what Iredell worried would happen. Unlike that of St. Thomas, see thesis number 4, his is a strongly but not completely libertarian understanding coupled with a restrictive anthropology. There are, to be sure, clauses in our American Constitution that might seem to invite relatively direct appeal to the natural law in the determination of the meaning. What, for example, are the rights retained by the people to which the Ninth Amendment points? Who has the authority to answer that question? Let's focus now on whether natural law theory has anything to say about what the answer to that second institutional question should be. St. Thomas surely does not answer it. The clear distinction between branches of government, which the question presupposes, dates back only as far as Montesquieu's 18th century Spirit of the Laws. Although it's certainly open to the writers of constitutions to give judges a final voice in the resolution of questions of whether a particular piece of legislation is consistent with natural law, it's not a tenet of natural law theory that they must do so. There are arguments on each side of the propriety of judicial supremacy on this question. Perhaps judges are more deliberate. On the other hand, perhaps they have no more experience in moral reasoning than do legislators and voters. Perhaps the relevant decision deliberation should be more democratic. As at least suggestive evidence in favor of my point that thesis 6 does not commit a judge to natural justice judicial review of human law, let me quote from one natural law, political, and moral theorist now sitting on the U.S. Supreme Court. Clarence Thomas, in the hearings preliminary to his confirmation, said, "I don't see a role for the use of natural law in constitutional adjudication," means by a judge. Why not? Our founders, the drafters of the 13th and 14th Amendment, abolitionists, believed in natural law, but they reduced it to positive law. The positive law is our Constitution, and when we look at constitutional adjudication, we look to that document. We may want to know, and I think it's important at times to understand what the drafters believed they were doing as a part of our history and tradition in some of the provisions, such as the liberty component of the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, but we don't make an independent search or an independent reference to some notion or a notion of natural law. So, by way of conclusion, how does St. Thomas' account of natural law bear on modern questions? First, it asserts the universality of objective moral principles, in that way protecting the rights and dignity of us all against the relativists. It does so in a way that makes the knowledge of those principles accessible to all rational beings, independent of their religious beliefs or lack of them. Second, somewhat more controversially, it offers an account of how specific guidance on various actions and practices can be derived from the self-evident fundamental precepts on which we can all agree. Finally, it both fits morality into a larger picture of the world and relates it to the task of making the laws that govern the communities in which we live.